I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 25th of January. 1 week before the Iowa caucus, we're going to talk some politics this hour of the show for all things political. Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest this hour, what he calls the kind of smash mouth in our face politics that Trump and Cruz are practicing. Republicans, he writes, have nobody to blame but themselves. The party needs to own up to the kind of politics that we now have. What happened to Jeb Bush? Is Marco Rubio still a possibility? We'll talk about that. Kathleen Parker writes recently, Nikki Haley should be the future of the Republican Party if it wants to survive. If she were to run as Marco Rubio's vice presidential pick, the two dynamic first-generation Americans would be a dream ticket that would give Democrats nightmares. Julian has an interesting piece in The Atlantic, how Jimmy Carter revolutionized the Iowa caucuses. He turned a major event, turned the whole thing into a major event in 1976. President Obama talked to Politico about Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, saying that Bernie came in with the luxury of being a completely long shot and just letting loose. I think Hillary came in with the privilege and burden of being perceived as the front runner. The person to whom he spoke at Politico said that they thought that he was kinder to Hillary Clinton. We'll be welcoming phone calls from you as politics is very much on our minds these days. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's the author of a number of books on U.S. presidents, including Jimmy Carter, another recent book, The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. He provides commentary for CNN.com and for many other media outlets. Professor Zelizer, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I've talked to so many people over the weekend because I talk politics on my off time, as I'm sure you do. People just can't remember an election like this one on the Republican side. It's just incredible, isn't it?
It sure is. The Republicans tend to be pretty orderly in their campaigns, certainly within the last few decades. So to see something of the chaos and unpredictability and to see two front runners who were not on the radar really when this started, I think is pretty surprising. And, you know, it's one of those genuine moments when we don't know what's going to come next. We're not just saying that to inflate a horse race. I think people don't actually know what's going to come next, so they're watching the results in Iowa.
You have written that the Republicans have nobody to blame but themselves. The party needs to own up to the kind of politics we now have. The style promoted by Trump, Cruz, and the entire Tea Party is a conscious product of the key decisions and strategic choices that mainstream Republican leaders have been making for decades. What do you mean?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of talk about establishment Republicans versus anti-establishment Republicans, with Trump and Cruz being the anti-establishment cohort. But the reality is a lot of their success grows out of aspects of Republican politics that we've been looking at recently if you observe the party. The alliance with a very aggressive party base between Republican candidates and activists is something that's been going on since Ronald Reagan ran in 1980. Another kind of the anti-government rhetoric that has been so prevalent with both of those candidates grows directly out of conservative philosophy. And finally, you know, the alliance with the Tea Party in particular is something that's been going on when John McCain picked Sarah Palin, and this emerged, and certainly since 2010 in Congress, the Republican leadership had embraced the Tea Party until they consumed Speaker Boehner. So I think it's wrong to say this just came out of nowhere and that there is nothing endemic in the Republican Party that explains why Trump and Cruz are having so much success.
You say that once Republicans forced the party to take Sarah Palin, the governor of Alaska, seriously as a vice presidential candidate, they opened a populist door that they will not easily shut. I thought that the response to what she had to say in her crazy 20-minute speech about Donald Trump, she didn't seem to be getting much traction other than a whole lot of comedians doing great impersonations.
Well, she didn't, although the question really isn't, you know, is she gaining traction in the press or even nationally? I think with her it was very specific to have her there to get traction in Iowa. And, you know, I don't know, but Trump's polls have actually been doing pretty good. They've increased, improved in the last few days. So although at first it might have seemed comical, there might have been something to the strategy.
Mm-hmm. Explain for me, in the conversation I was having with friends last night, everybody was a little bit upset by the level of discourse here, that there isn't a lot of substantial discourse, that what people are talking about you can't quite imagine coming from the mouth of a president of the United States, the meanness, the nastiness, some of the policies that really are rather dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that has been troubling to many people, and certainly in that case, Donald Trump has led the way, although some of his colleagues have echoed comments that he's made, you know, using slightly modified language. Part of it is, you know, we have a nostalgia and we forget the ugly aspect of Democratic politics and the kind of rhetoric we've heard before. You just look back to 1988 when George H.W. Bush's supporters had the Willie Horton ad, which was seen as a real nasty example of racial advertising in campaign politics. Part of it is the environment we're in now with Twitter and social media, where the candidates have really strong incentives to say things that will get attention. And often it's controversy that gets attention. And finally, it's this element, certainly, of Republican politics, a hardline, a right-wing element, which on some issues like immigration says things that are far off center from where many Americans are.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to just a little bit of one of the latest things that Donald Trump had to say and explain, I think he's right, why his poll numbers can go up, even if he says something that, you know, if I could have said this, he didn't say it as, he just said it to show his poll numbers could go up. But here's just an example, one of many, about Donald Trump's rhetoric.
The people, my people are so smart. And you know what else they say about my people? The polls. They say, I have the most loyal people. Did you ever see that? Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? It's like incredible.
What kind of comment is that?
It's, you know, astounding.
It is astounding.
But not surprising anymore. And this is the kind of comment we've certainly come to expect from him, where he... It's not that he doesn't think through what he's going to say. He doesn't really care about how it's perceived by a lot of the country. But the fact is, once again, here we are. You and I are talking about
right.
it, talking about him. And this has been a, you know, story that has been consistent since he announced. He says things like this that are provocative, that get him national attention exactly at the right moment. And even with the cost of alienating some people who probably wouldn't support him anyway, he gets the attention he wants, and some people like it, even if they don't, you know, they say it's either a joke or they say they like to hear someone who just says what they're thinking. It's part of the kind of anti-PC argument that you often hear in American politics now.
You mentioned Kathleen Parker, a couple of her columns. I thought this was interesting that Nikki Haley, she writes, should be the future of the Republican Party if it wants to survive. If she were to run as Marco Rubio's vice presidential pick, that they could form a dream ticket that would give the Democrats nightmares. I think that's true.
It is true. It certainly would be a problem and certainly would be a very different kind of ticket than, you know, one focused on Donald Trump or Ted Cruz. It would represent a kind of different part of the Republican Party. It would symbolize a fresh new generation of Republicans who don't fit into the stereotype that many Americans or certainly Democrats have of the party, and potentially the ability to reach a broader coalition of voters. That said, you know, they would still be representing a party that on issues like immigration is seen as very much in opposition to liberalizing policies. And Nikki Haley has been very conservative on most issues other than the Confederate flag, as has Marco Rubio. So Even if they were the ticket, it would be exciting. It would be different, and I think it would scare Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, and that's another issue.
Mm-hmm.
But there would still be challenges if they wanted to change what the party was about because of the policy stance of the GOP.
And we'll get to Bernie and Hillary in just a moment. What do you make, Professor Zelizer, of the Supreme Court agreeing to review whether the president overstepped his authority with his overhaul of the nation's immigration rules?
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised. I mean, the court has given the president trouble. The courts have given the president trouble over the past year on his immigration plans, on some climate change plans, where he has used executive power as a way to circumvent intransigence on Capitol Hill. But what has happened is conservatives have challenged him every step of the way in the courts, and the courts are responding. And so I think these are big issues for him because this is really where most of his gains have been in the last year. And if the court ties this up or ultimately knocks it down, it would be a huge blow for him.
Let's move to the Democratic side. The president gave an interview with Politico. According to the article, the president did not utter an unkind word about Bernie Sanders, who has been respectfully critical of his administration's reluctance to prosecute Wall Street executives and also to abandon a single health care system. But, the author writes, he was kinder to Hillary Clinton.
Well, that's interesting, and some of the comments he made about Sanders in terms of Hillary Clinton having the difficulties that come from experience and that come from someone who really wants to make real change as opposed to the inspirational candidate are a little ironic, obviously, to hear from Barack Obama, who ran with some of
right.
the same spirit as Bernie Sanders
mm-hmm.
back in 2008. But he's sending a clear signal. Hillary Clinton in the last debate tied herself to the administration and made an argument, voting for me, we can continue with some of the best parts of this presidency. And with this interview, I think you're hearing and seeing the president take a little more proactive stand, as many Democrats are worried, certainly Clinton supporters, that Sanders is much more formidable than they thought.
Why did she decide to, and was it a change of thought on her part, to tie herself more closely to the Obama administration?
Yeah, I think it's somewhat of a change. I mean, the basic message is not different. She's about incremental reform, and she is making an argument. I have experience, and I can actually get change rather than just talk about it. So it's a kind of logical next step to connect yourself to the administration to which you worked, with which you worked, and to remind the nation and certainly Democratic voters of all that happened in the first 2 years of the Obama presidency. But it's not without its costs, and I'm not sure it deflected some of what Sanders supporters find appealing about him.
Does she get, I'm trying to break down these poll numbers and to get a better understanding of this. Obviously, Bernie Sanders has a pretty strong record on civil rights that is not very well known. Hillary Clinton has the support, I understand, of large numbers of minority voters in this country. Are those polls accurate? And if so, why is that the case, Julian?
Well, I think they're accurate. You know, I haven't sorted through the poll numbers, so I don't know, but I'm assuming they are. I think, you know, part of it is African Americans are very loyal to the Democratic Party, and she still is the front runner, and she still is the main voice of the Democratic Party at this point. So I don't know if that will change if Sanders gains steam. You know, I think there are many African Americans, many progressives even, who are worried that, you know, Sanders won't get anything done. They are now aware of the Republican power in Washington and understand or sense that, you know, if you're making a bet on one of the two candidates to be able to fight for change and to preserve what's been accomplished, Hillary Clinton's a better bet. And some of it might have to do with fond feelings toward Bill Clinton and the presidency of the 1990s, even though you can argue that was pretty controversial for many African Americans, there's still something to that. So, you know, Sanders still needs to make a stronger case if he's going to pick up what are critical votes in many states.
Mm-hmm. It is really amazing that you have a Democratic socialist who's running strongly in some states in this country, and that he's calling for a single-payer health system, that he's calling on, you know, really taking on Wall Street and addressing the income gap in a fairly significant way. And what he's saying, a lot of people are listening to and saying, you're right, and we support you.
Yeah, it's kind of stunning, to be honest. Someone who studied American politics in the 50s and 60s, and even in the 80s and 90s, you know, being tagged as a socialist was a political, you know, liability of the highest level. And it's not just that he calls himself a socialist. He stands for policies which are very, very progressive in terms of where we are in American politics. And he does it unabashedly and without any reservation.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know if there's a lot of the population likes his policies or they identify with the philosophy, or some, like they do with Trump, might like to see a politician who says what they think and doesn't care about the conventional wisdom in a very different way, obviously. There is something refreshing, I think, for many Democrats to see Sanders say what's obviously true on some issues, including, you know, big money in politics.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls for Professor Julian Zelizer. It's All Things Political for this Monday, the week before. It's 1 week from today, the Iowa caucus. Julian's written a very interesting piece about Jimmy Carter and how he really knew how to use the Iowa caucus to catapult himself to national celebrity and ultimately to the presidency. We'll talk about that as we continue, but we'll take phone calls on what's already been said in just a moment. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter is @KDunnShow. Professor Zelizer has a very keen political mind and historical mind as well. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of Jimmy Carter and The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. He provides commentary for CNN and many other media outlets. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I think Bernie came in with the luxury of being a complete long shot.
Right.
And just letting loose.
Right.
I think Hillary came in with the both privilege and burden of being perceived as the front runner.
President Obama, with his thoughts about, well, just part of the very long conversation, including his thoughts about Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders' interview in Politico. We go to phone calls now for our guest, Professor Julian Zelizer, and we start with Mike in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Howdy.
Hi.
You know, I'm glad that he spoke to this issue. I think comparing Trump to Bernie Sanders, I think Bernie is being just a little outrageous by saying, I'm new and I'm different because I'm a socialist, so people, he's branding himself to differentiate himself from, say, Clinton. Because I really don't think that Bernie Sanders lives up to the name of a socialist. I think he's a New Deal Democrat. He doesn't want to the state taking over any of the businesses as a socialist would or a communist. But I the thing that I really worry about now between the two of them, Hillary and Bernie, Hillary, since, let me put it this way, since the political spectrum has moved so far to the right, Hillary is a moderate Republican, Bernie is the true like deal Democrat, and I think that's really what way they should be defined.
I mean, I think that's actually a good point. I would argue that we often miss some of what people like about Bernie Sanders when we talk about why is a socialist doing well. If you listen to his rhetoric, he is very liberal. I do think in today's perspective, especially in the post-Tea Party world, he's very left. But a lot of his core arguments are really basic New Deal, Great Society arguments. He is very open about tapping into the political tradition that has defined Democrats. You know, he's a little like Ted Kennedy in 1980. So that excites some Democrats. You know, he has a whole thing on the campaign trail And it's a very basic message. Government is good. Government has worked. And it's ridiculous to say that government always fails. And he gives you a million examples of what it does well. And I think he is not a socialist by European standards, but he is a democratic socialist who continues a tradition that's been around in the United States. I don't think Hillary Clinton's a moderate Republican. I think certainly compared to Bernie Sanders, she might sound that way. But I think if you look at their policies, she's still very much in that New Deal tradition. So I do think, though, the caller's talking about something that is at the core of why some people like Sanders. He's not embarrassed about what the party has been about.
So what kind of definition, political definition, do you give to Donald Trump or Ted Cruz?
Well, Ted Cruz is certainly a conservative Republican, and I don't think there's any other way but that to describe who he is. He comes out of the party. He's worked for the party for a long time, including in the 2000 recount, as there was an article today reminding us. And he stands for what social conservatives and economic conservatives have been pushing for a long time. Donald Trump's more eclectic. He does support some policies which are certainly not in the Republican canon. But overall, where he is right now, he's kind of promoting a pro-market, anti-government philosophy, which fits nicely with the GOP. And he supported some very hardline anti-immigration combined with tough, hawkish national security positions, which are not, an anomaly in Republican politics recently. So I think they're Republicans and they're conservative Republicans of different varieties.
Lou in Iowa. Hi, Lou.
Hello. I think Hillary could lose Iowa and New Hampshire and still win this thing, and I think that's what's going to happen. And I think that Cruz would be easier to beat than either Rubio or Trump. My question is, if Hillary wins the nomination, do you think she'll go after a particular state to win with her VP pick? And is it still true that women and Hispanics will decide the general election? If you get the majority of women and Hispanics, is that going to be, I hear all these pundits saying that if you do win women and do win Hispanics, you're going to win this election. How do you see it, Professor?
Well, first, in terms of Iowa and New Hampshire, I think Lou is right in that, we make a lot of these early contests. In recent decades, you had to win one of the two to win the nomination, although, many people have won Iowa, like Mike Huckabee, who did not go on to do much more, Rick Santorum. So it's possible she loses and does very well, as we get into March and secures the nomination. In terms of the VP, we don't pick VPs really for states anymore. That's just not how it works. There's no more, Lyndon Johnson's, John F. Kennedy in 1960 picked Johnson really to get Texas and to get the South, but Texas in particular. That's not how it works anymore. Now people are partnered because of how it impacts your overall image in terms of the electorate and the media, in terms of sending a message about public policy, partnering center-right or center-left, and that's how the candidates think much more about it. So, people have talked for Hillary Clinton, for example, of Julian Castro kind of send a message about immigration, about where the Democrats stand, about mobilizing immigrant votes. And finally, sure, the female vote could be a huge issue and a huge boon to the Democrats for Hillary Clinton. And immigrants will play a big role in many states like Colorado. The question is, what kind of a backlash vote do you get? Part of what Trump is doing is really stirring up white men. And it's possible that, you have a Hillary Clinton who does well with women and does well with immigrants, but you have a huge and very active voting turnout from the white male vote that has gone recently for Republicans. So I don't know kind of which direction that will go, especially with a Trump in the race.
Thank you, Lou. And as long as Lou is calling in from Iowa, Let's talk a little bit about Iowa. Take a trip down memory lane, if you don't mind, because you wrote a very interesting piece in The Atlantic on Jimmy Carter in Iowa, the 1976 campaign. His successful campaign started, you write, in small rural Iowa. He knew how to work that state, didn't he?
He did. You know, when Jimmy Carter got into the race in 1974 and 75, nobody knew who he was. No one, none of the polls predicted that he was even going to register in the list of possible nominees. There were many big nominees running, like Birch Bayh of Indiana or Henry Scoop Jackson of Washington, senators with a lot of clout, Frank Church of Idaho. But one of the things that Jimmy Carter and his team, like Jody Powell, understood or they learned was that he might do well in Iowa, and by doing well in Iowa, which had just moved a couple years earlier in 72 to being the first contest of the race rather than coming in May, that if he did well there, he would get media attention, he would get the press to talk about him as a serious front runner, and he can use what today we call momentum from the victory to actually start accumulating delegates, even if Iowa didn't really have much to offer. And so he takes it very seriously, runs a basically two-month campaign in Iowa, staged for the media, and it works beautifully. And it turns Iowa into the kind of contest that it is today. And it also introduces a media-focused campaign style that where it's about the story. It's about making yourself a certain kind of candidate to reporters, not just to voters or party bosses. That is absolutely at the heart of modern campaigning.
Mm. I love your reference. I would love to see a video of this, Julian, where he dresses up in an apron and a chef hat to show how he liked to cook fillet of fish. And everybody,
yes.
That's great, isn't it?
Yeah, he did that on one of the local Iowa, you know, morning news shows, and it was very successful. I guess there were videos of it that would keep playing on the news for several weeks.
I'll have to look that up this afternoon after we're off the air. Let's go to Leslie in Tomahawk next. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have an issue with your guest's description of a comment that Donald Trump made as provocative. And, of course, that's the one where Donald Trump pointed his finger at the camera and said he could shoot someone out on Fifth Avenue and never lose a vote. That was anything but a provocative statement. To me, that was a very dangerous statement. It was a degradation to every family that has lost someone by violence, by gun violence. And I think that every Republican, Democrat, Independent should take a long, long look at this man who is running to represent all of us. And I'd like to know also, where is the outrage over that comment mm-hmm. that he made? All I hear is glorification in that he says what he wants to say. But it was a horrible, terrible thing to do.
He said a lot of horrible things. There should be a whole lot of outrage about many of the things he says, I think, Professor Zelizer.
Yeah, I mean, I think many people feel the way Leslie does and don't like hearing a presidential candidate really make light of shooting someone, you know, in any form. And it's, it can be seen certainly as offensive, as dangerous, as, you know, not the kind of statement we want to hear from a person who kids are watching and understand could be the next president of the United States. It was provocative. That's exactly what it did. It provoked anger, it provoked debate, and it provoked attention on him, which is why he did it. But you were right. There is a long list of statements. Every time he makes one, people are like, okay, this is it. This is the one where he went over the line. But he understands maybe better than a lot of us. That line doesn't exist anymore, or it's very hard to see where it starts and where it ends. And candidates can get away with a lot, and he has a lot of supporters who feel differently. They like to hear him talk this way. They like to hear that in-your-face kind of politics right now, and they like the anger. I think there's a part of it that, like, both the anger and the arrogance. You know, traditionally we think we don't want arrogant politicians, but this year's certainly different. And I think there's some appeal for part of the electorate of a person who just thinks, you know, he is the guy and knows it and is not shy about explaining why, even with statements like this.
Let's go to an email. When the revelations of Bill Clinton's extraction of $20-plus million from activities connected to the foundation, I thought it would have a great impact on the legitimacy of Hillary's campaign. It quickly disappeared from media attention. Are the Republicans waiting to spring this into the mix at a more opportune time?
I'm sure it'll come back. I mean, nothing was really proven to be illegal or even unethical, but there are certainly a lot of questions raised about, you know, why the foundation was engaged in some of these activities at the same time she was involved in politics. I don't think Republicans feel like they need to do that right now. Bernie Sanders is doing it, and, you know, he talked about the Goldman Sachs speeches, and that is still part of the same story, and I think it did do damage to her. I think it was part of a narrative we have where she's too connected to the existing political system, and she's not careful, neither is her husband, in terms of separating the world of money and the world of politics. So I think when Sanders goes after her in a debate and raises these speaking fees, which on the face of it don't seem like they should be the end of the world for a candidate, it brings back all these stories you've been reading and those kinds of accusations. But in a general election, Republicans will throw everything out and bring all those stories front and center.
Our number is 800-486-8655, and you're listening to All Things Political on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio with Professor Julian Zelizer from Princeton, a presidential historian, written a lot of books, and does quite a bit of commentary for CNN and other outlets. We have lines open for you. They've been crowded. If you want to get through, now is the time to call. Willem in Colfax is next. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about Donald Trump in general. When I've listened to him on interviews and things like that, he, like opposed to like what Bernie Sanders or other politicians say, they usually say we, but Donald Trump always says I. And if there's any attack on him, like the National Review or any other newspaper or anything like that, he always right away starts with his ad hominem attack, like, that's a failing newspaper, or those people are losers.
Right.
And he never has any definitive plans on what he wants to do. And what I really don't understand is they say he has support amongst evangelical Christians when actually he hasn't ever uttered a Christian word to my recollection. I mean, he's totally contrary to the teachings of Jesus Christ. I mean, Jesus Christ was all about love thy neighbor and what you do unto me. What you do unto the least of these, you do unto me. And these are not the principles of Donald Trump. So I don't understand his appeal to what's called the Christian right.
Well, in terms of the I part, I think that is an astute comment. And it's very much how Donald Trump, since the 1980s, has always gone about his business. He's made it about him. And he's very big on the brand. He has created a brand that he has used in real estate, he is used in casinos, he is used on television, where he is the center. He is what you either like or who you love to hate. And I think he has translated this into presidential politics. And he also uses it to some degree to separate himself from the Republican Party, which can be effective. To say you're voting for me, you're not voting for all the problems that you see with Washington and the party. In terms of the attacks, he is methodical, and everyone knows this, and I think a lot of candidates are scared of him. He will go after you if you attack him, and we've seen him do this from Megyn Kelly in that first debate through every single Republican who's turned their attention to him. He will go and throw everything at you that he knows about. And finally, with the evangelicals, if the polls are true, it is surprising with him. He has not lived an evangelical life. He's not
lived a religious life.
Personally,
right.
It's not simply his policies. But look, you know, Ronald Reagan also didn't really live a religious life at all. And, you know, he was a Hollywood guy. And he was able to appeal in 1980 to the religious right, not because he necessarily was who they were and what they wanted, but ultimately he would represent their coalition in Washington. And so maybe some evangelicals are saying this guy's a winner and he will give the Republican Party their best shot.
A Twitter comment, question for you. What are your thoughts about strong support for Sanders by Republican mischief makers?
That could be in some of the primaries where anyone can vote. There certainly might be a temptation to throw your support for Sanders. I never know how much of that actually happens. And there might be pundits who talk, for conservative ones, who talk favorably about Sanders in an effort to, you know, give the Democrats a candidate who cannot win. And so I'm sure that's an element, but I don't think that's in the end what will carry him. What will carry him is this immense enthusiasm that he has stirred with parts of the Democratic electorate and his ability to bring out, again, like Obama did, people who usually don't vote,
right,
don't participate in politics, and they like what they're seeing,
mm-hmm,
and they feel it's not just him either. It's kind of a movement. So Sanders is certainly relevant, but he's not at the heart of what is driving them to support this.
And there are a whole lot of people who don't vote, aren't there, Julian?
There are a lot of people who don't vote. And then, you know, it's the trend of the 20th and 21st century has generally been downward for voting. In congressional elections, midterm elections, a very small percentage vote. In primaries and caucuses, you're talking about a very small portion of these states are voting. And in general elections, it's better, but it's still not great. So that, too, is part of what I think Sanders is trying to tap into, the people who don't think the system works anymore and don't even come out to vote. And to some extent, Trump's appealing to the same people in the Republican
mm-hmm.
Party.
Willem, thanks so much for your call. We're speaking this hour on All Things Political with Professor Julian Zelizer. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and he is a New America Fellow. He is the author of a number of books, including a good one on Jimmy Carter, titled Jimmy Carter. Also, The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. He does a lot of commentary for CNN.com and other media outlets. We'll be welcoming more phone calls momentarily. One line is open if you'd like to grab it. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. We were reminiscing about Jimmy Carter. It's interesting, of course, as we're in 2016, to look at events that gave us what we have now. We wonder, why is Iowa so prominent? Well, partially because of what Jimmy Carter did, and I thought we would hear a little bit more about that before we return to your phone calls.
Here are the first political returns for the year 1976. Yesterday, about 50,000 Democrats in Iowa met in caucuses in homes, churches, and firehouses to choose delegates for their state party convention. Most of them are still uncommitted, 37%. But former Georgia Governor Jimmy Carter did extremely well with 27% of the delegate preferences, more than twice as many as Indiana Senator Birch Bayh and three times as many as Fred Harris, the former Oklahoma senator.
Professor Julian Zelizer is with us this hour, and we go to Phil in Hebron, Illinois next. Hi, Phil.
Good afternoon, all. I have a quick question for you. I read the New York Times yesterday and read all the information on Mr. Bloomberg. I wouldn't say I'm a big supporter, but I find it very interesting. He said in his comments that he feels Hillary Clinton has a problem being truthful, and that's a need for him to run. Do we have any reason to believe Mr. Bloomberg really doesn't believe that, and he's not being truthful?
Well, you know, Bloomberg has said there's always speculation about him running, so we need to at least start with remembering this isn't the first time this has happened. And he's the, you know, candidate who might get into it and causes a stir and then doesn't. I don't know what's driving him. There might be part of him that has something against Hillary Clinton, although the odds of him running if Hillary Clinton is the nominee are very slim. I don't think he knows he can't win. He knows in many ways it might be a wasted effort. So I think that kind of comment is to prod her to be more aggressive. I think what he really does not want is either a Bernie Sanders Democratic ticket, and that's a situation he thinks he could do pretty well against. And I think there is part of him that doesn't like, obviously, what's happened to the Republican Party. And wouldn't be happy if Trump's the next president. But Hillary Clinton's the one person I think, you know, he is not really going to go up against. So any comment about her is less positioning himself to run against her, my guess, is than to kind of say you need to strengthen your campaign on this front.
Mike is joining us in Kentucky. Hi, Mike.
Hey, yeah. Thanks for having me on. I just got 3 points. I think that when you were saying that Trump said he could shoot someone, wasn't he repeating something that got wrote about him? I mean, it's not like he come up with that. That's one thing. And another thing is, I don't know if you considered that there's a whole bunch of Democrats. I know I'm one of them. If he gets the nominee, we're going to vote for him, too. And the reason for that is that he don't have to go ask somebody what he thinks. He knows what he thinks.
And what do you, wait, before you go on, Mike, what do you like about what he thinks?
What I like about what he thinks is he's not lying. If I have to go ask somebody what I need to say, then I'm coming back with a lie. Mr. Trump, he's saying what he thinks. That's what we need.
Okay, and I'm sorry, you had maybe a point number three?
I think I did. What he said.
Yeah.
And the fact that there's a lot of Democrats already that will vote for him, people I've talked to. We register Democrats, but if he wins the nomination, we're definitely going to vote for him over Bernie or Hillary, either one.
So you really think he could be a good president?
I think that that a lot of things he wants to do, he'll be like the rest of the presidents. He won't be able to do them, but he will put his heart in it and be honest about it. He'll try to get the job done.
Professor Zelizer.
Well, those are a lot of remarks. On the shooting comment, I had not heard that yet. And at least from the response of a lot of Republicans, they at least also seem to think this was coming from him. And he was expressing his own views. In terms of him speaking the truth and saying what he thinks, regardless of whether you like it or not, that is at the heart of why people like him. It's not necessarily what he says. It's not even the policies he stands for. It's the aggressive and truthful and in-your-face attitude he at least appears to convey. And there are some voters who find this very refreshing. And I think, you know, if you look at the polls at this point, everyone needs to acknowledge this is the case. And in terms of the Democrats, I don't know. I think there are Democrats who might vote for him. I have trouble kind of figuring out if the polls are all truthful. We've had a lot of attention on are people who say they support Trump really going to vote for him. I think an equally important question is, are there people who might vote for him who aren't saying that when pollsters ask them?
Yes.
Including Democrats who might actually like him and find him appealing. And my guess is Trump's, you know, pollsters and Trump's campaign people are counting on that.
Thank you for your call, Mike. John in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Two broad questions to your guest. One is, regarding LBJ, the book by Roger Stone, how would you compare his book vis-a-vis JFK with your book? And the second question is, did Huey Long and Father Coughlin force the bond broker FDR to the left in the late 1930s after Huey Long helped get helped get Roosevelt nominated, but later turned on him because he would not throw the money changers out of the temple, in the same way with Father Coughlin.
Professor Zelizer.
Yeah, well, the Roger Stone book, if anyone wants to read it, they can. He's a political consultant, you know, very prominent opposition research person for the Republican Party, and he's written books on Nixon, on LBJ and plots to the plot to kill Kennedy, and so people can read it and see what they think. In terms of FDR, that's not the characterization I would have of Franklin Roosevelt. He's certainly one of the most liberal presidents that we've had, and he institutes huge reforms on our financial system and on Wall Street that really, in perspective, are pretty bold. In 1936, what the caller is referring to is FDR is challenged from the left. Huey Long, a senator, calls for a much more ambitious program of relief, Father Coughlin is much more a kind of conservative demagogue populist who often appeals to anti-Semitic rhetoric in his comments, and in some ways reflects some of the things we continue to hear in American politics. They did shake up the campaign. Huey Long, not Coughlin, certainly pushed FDR to the left in the campaign. And, you know, I think they were going to perpetually be disappointed. Coughlin's views moved so far to the right and toward anti-Semitic ideas that there was no way he was going to accept what an FDR or any other mainstream politician did at that point.
Hmm. FDR was such a significant president, wasn't he?
He was huge. He, in terms of public policy, really remade with the Democratic Congress what the relationship was between our government and Americans, from insuring bank accounts to make sure you didn't lose all your money, to providing public relief, to creating Social Security, which was this new commitment for the elderly, and much, much more. And as a person, as a president, he loomed very large in the life of many Americans. He really, for many, saved the country from serious threat, economic threat in the 1930s, and he mobilizes the country for a war against fascism in Germany and Japan. And so his stature is really almost unequaled, other than Abraham Lincoln to this day.
Yeah. Thanks, John, for your call. Dick in Iowa. We had a lot of Iowa callers here. Hi, Dick.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm wondering why everybody seems to have forgotten that there is a third Democrat running, Martin O'Malley, who I intend to caucus for. Largely on the basis that, as far as anything I've been able to find, he doesn't have any of the negatives that both Clinton and Sanders have.
In many ways, he's an attractive candidate, Julian. What happened to him?
He is. I'm sure he's asking the same question every night. And I don't think he fully understands it. For a while, he was seen as a kind of up-and-coming, you know, new generation Democrat. He's on the right page on many issues like gun control and same-sex marriage before the other candidates joined him. And he's pretty telegenic. You know, he's had a number of issues. One was the Baltimore, and his record as mayor of Baltimore was very controversial. He instituted some of the policing practices that became a source of great controversy after Ferguson, after the Baltimore riots, and I do think that dragged him down. Part of it, it's just not his time this year. You know, Hillary Clinton is a giant candidate, and it's hard to knock her down. And then this other person came in with a bigger grassroots presence and this, you know, inspirational appeal that he doesn't have. That's not his strength. So it might be he runs and he, you know, maybe he's a VP, or maybe he runs again in a few years and is better. And he is kind of, you know, restrained and calm. And it seems like candidates want fervor and fire.
Yes.
And that's not who he is.
How true.
I think that's part of what's going on.
So, Dick, how many ads are you seeing?
Well, I'm on the road most of the time, so I don't really see a lot. Lately, as far as what we're getting in the mail, it's all coming from Sanders.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for bringing up Martin O'Malley. You're right. We haven't talked about him very much, and it's a legitimate question. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I hope we can do this in 45 seconds. Dan, can we do it?
We can try. It's
okay.
About culture, not politics. I think that a lot of people that claim they're going to be voting for Hillary and that have her signs on the lawn are going to be pulling the lever for Trump because they don't like the way the country's going.
And why do they think Trump's going to move it in the better direction?
I think the biggest thing is because he's outside of normal politics. I think so many people that I come in contact with are convinced that there's no difference between the Republicans and Democrats and that they're both thoroughly corrupt and will say anything to get elected.
And you don't think Donald Trump will say anything to get elected?
I'm sure anybody that wants to be president will say pretty much anything to get elected, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that the Republicans and Democrats are pretty much opposite sides of the same coin.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. I just want there to be a level of intelligence about all of this, Professor Zelizer. Some of these debates are just, are you kidding me? Can we talk about, can we elevate this discussion some?
Agreed. And I think even though in the short term there might be some appeal for this person who doesn't play the game of politics that seems broken, his style might actually break it even further and might be exactly what's wrong with politics, not what's going to correct it. And I think part of that's part of the challenge that other Republicans face right now in explaining to voters, and certainly Hillary Clinton will as well.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure to have you on the air. Professor Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton, author of Jimmy Carter and several other books. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to K.P. Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee.